four, five.
Two, three, four, five.
Testing, one, two, three, four, five. This is a continuation of an interview with Mary Ellen Rudin, and we're talking for the moment about Preston Hammer, whom you've just had a letter from. And you're saying that he's probably in his 70s by now and that he weighed 300 pounds. Go on.
He had been a member of the mathematics department for some years here. He was not a man of the same mathematical stature as anyone else in the department. His field was topology, and he had never done anything of any significance in the field. In the mid-1950s, he started getting very excited about topologies on finite sets and the empty set. He was a real fan of the empty set, and he thought that the empty set, there was an empty set of ladies, and there was an empty set of gentlemen, and there was an empty set of houses, and that there were lots of different empty sets, and he got very excited about this idea, and he started going to meetings of the American Mathematical Society and making speeches that upset the mathematics department because they thought he was saying nothing and was putting them in a bad light by being the vision of the University of Wisconsin. And I don't know, I was not involved in the politics of it at all, but either because he felt unloved and unwanted, or because the mathematics department wanted to divorce itself from its association with him, he became, and because he was interested in computers, he started the computer science department. And so he is the father of the computer science department at the University of Wisconsin, and actually he didn't start it in a terribly bad way, in any way except that he was there, which made people a little anxious about it, because someone who's reputedly a little crazy, being the head of something, is difficult for it to live with. At the same time, he was the man who got it started. He was a strange man, very smart in a way. He knew all kinds of things. He had much broader interests than the average mathematician. He was not terribly good at mathematics, and therefore he was very interested in all sorts of side things, cultural and otherwise. And he was very good at combinatorics, that is, jiggling small numbers. He was very good at the kinds of things that really are involved in computers, that looking at the 0-1 type functions. He was interested in these things and had some technical knowledge of the mechanics of the engineering of building computers, I think, at any rate more than the average person in the mathematics department had at that time. And he had his family, his wife Hilda and his daughter Kate, and he had a large family. They were very social and enthusiastic. Everybody loved them. They were they lived on a farm, and they invited everybody out for raspberries and corn, and they were part of the social life of the mathematics department. The Cleanies, the Bings, the Brucks were all close to them personally, and therefore found Preston's strange mathematical activities a little hard to deal with, because it's like stabbing a friend in the back when he's sick. It really, his mathematics seemed almost sick. Because he was a bright man, that is, that he should, in some ways, he was very smart. He seemed to have a very selective way of using his mind. That is, sometimes he used it for, in a very highly technical way, and used it very well. And other times he did very trivial things, which, and he would get just as excited about the trivial things, which was strange. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he felt unloved and unwanted at the time that he left here.
When did he leave?
Must have been 1958 or 59, something like that. He went to Penn State. He was there for a long time. Again, he became very separated from the mathematics department, and I think he went somewhere else, but I actually don't know. Let me, he says Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the letter that I just received from him, but doesn't say anything about any university.
Presumably he's retired.
Presumably he's retired. Mm. But I don't know what university he was associated with at the end,
yeah,
if any. He may have become just sufficiently difficult that I saw him about 15 years ago, maybe, at a meeting of the American Mathematical Society in Penn State. We were there, and the Hammers invited us out. He showed up at the mathematics meeting and invited us to come out to the house in the evening, and we did, and invited many other people. But I was eager to see Hilda, who I hadn't seen in a long time, and they seemed very much like they had here, very interesting house to go to, interesting people, but at the same time, he was doing essentially no mathematics at that time.
Did you ever talk to him about his past or about his way of thinking? Did you know him well enough to
not a great deal.
I just wondered if you had any or if he was aware of how
strange he came across. Oh, I think he was. Oh, I think he was. And was perfectly willing to, well, he thought the rest of us were foolish not to agree with him. I know he realizes that the talks that he's planning to give to the American Medical Society will be a slight embarrassment to his friends.
Will he be
and actually, oh yes, it's part of the rules of the game that for 10 minutes you could say anything you want to.
Is that customary in associations?
I don't know, but it is for the American Mathematical Society. If you're a member of the American Mathematical Society and there's a meeting, if you send in an abstract for the meeting, you can, for a talk,
yeah,
you can talk for 10 minutes without being, you can invite yourself,
yeah,
to give a talk, and you can say anything you please.
That's
and you do get a certain number of nuts,
yeah,
one kind,
yeah,
and another, but then also you give every one of the members a chance to say whatever they have to say, even though they may not be sufficiently well known to be invited to give a talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the way young people give talks all the time,
yeah,
is that they have an opportunity just to say, I want to talk, and they do. So it's hard with something like a talk on the death of the theory of ideas to decide where what part of the program you'll put this in. But they probably have a section on mathematical logic or something, mm-hmm, which will include this talk.
So you say he felt he would have felt unloved when he left.
Yes.
But on the other hand, that he really didn't object to the criticism because, in fact, he didn't think, he thought all of you were doing the wrong thing.
No,
so.
I think he thought that he was right, and that we were misguided. And I think that very much the situation existed with him that still exists. That is, I think of Preston Hammer as a friend, and I will write him a letter in reply to this one saying, do come and see us when you come to town. It was possible to separate your social life from your mathematical life. He was loved in spite of the fact that he wasn't doing things mathematically appreciated by the mathematics department, but he certainly knew that he was not doing things that the mathematics department thought was correct mm-hmm. mathematically, or interesting mathematically.
Yeah. But you, non-trivial. But you really do care about him. It's not that you feel sorry
no.
for him. Or
no, no. I really, he's an interesting person, and I have enjoyed him. It's the honest truth, and so I wouldn't. And I'm sure it's even more so true with Steve Kleene, with R.H. Bing, with Bruck, that they were friends, and that on some level they're still friends, but that the fact that his actually it's very much like a person who has had a mental breakdown mm-hmm. that lasted for 25 years.
Well, that's what I wondered. In that case, there is an element of,
that's
where
I've always
sorry for
yeah,
him, but
yeah.
That's the wrong
you feel
term.
Sorry for him in a way. That is, you think of this as an illness. I really do. Which is in some way different from other kinds of things that might go wrong with you.
Yeah. I was going to find what Steve Kleene brought. He didn't say very much, but he did say that he wasn't terribly hard-headed about what would work.
Yeah.
And that many people couldn't quite take the things he was pressing for.
Yeah.
Which is, but that's about all he would say. He did say that he had, I think he said he liked him, or anyway.
Yeah.
He certainly wasn't speaking against him. This was just, because I was telling him what Steve Robinson had said. Do you know him?
No.
Well, he was a very bright high school student who got to work part-time, I guess, in the numerical
analysis
lab.
Yeah.
As a high school student, and then came here and kept on being involved. He's now in computer sciences and in some form of engineering.
Yeah.
He knew Preston Hammer. He liked him very. He called him an imaginative person.
Yeah.
And he said that the math department
well,
was
this
very
is this is certainly true. Is that Hammer was a tremendously imaginative person who had extremely good ideas sometimes mm-hmm. and extremely crazy, obviously impossible ideas other times, and it was hard for people to deal with his two sides of a man. And I think he did good things for the computer science department and the people that were there. He did not harm them by his peculiar mathematical ideas. And I think the program that he started at Penn State was good. But then again, he became a little strange and they didn't go through with it.
Now, you know, this started off as the Numerical Analysis Laboratory.
Yeah.
That's what he was the director
of the Numerical Analysis Laboratory.
I don't suppose you know how he was hired, who brought him here.
I have no idea. He was here long before we came.
Ah, I see. When did you come?
1958. Oh. And so he was here only for a short time after we came, but I knew him before we came.
Oh, you did? How?
I had been to Madison to meetings of the American Mathematical Society and had seen him at such
things. Yes, you would
things.
Never forget him, evidently.
Right.
You did see
He's
him.
Very unique person in lots of ways, not only his size.
Yes.
But,
Steve Robinson said he thought that his personality was crucial to the course of computing at the UW, and I think Steve Robinson felt that computing might have been more closely associated with mathematics if it hadn't been for Preston Hammer.
Yes, I'm sure that's true.
Is that true in other universities?
I think computer science has developed in many different ways at many different universities. At the time that it got going at most places, the 50s, it wasn't clear whether it should be math. There were very few mathematicians that were involved.
Mm-hmm.
There were some. And often it was people interested in numerical analysis that started at other places. It would be someone in the engineering school who was interested in the construction of the hardware. It might be people in the mathematics department who wanted who wanted it to be very close to the mathematics department realized that this was something that was very important in the mathematician's future, and who would, that is, you might have mathematicians very much involved in it. At Wisconsin, one would think so, actually, and I think that's true most places, but not as many as you would think, because most mathematicians doing traditional mathematics don't have much use for a computer or much interest in a computer.
He did say that no mathematicians, at least at some time, were using the computer at all.
Steve Kleene is interesting in that he was a man who was interested in computers always, partly because the kind of logic that he did was applicable to computing. And so he had more knowledge and interest in computing than the average person in the mathematics department.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's something you can really speculate as to how I gather this may be true then, what Steve Robinson's saying, how different it might have been.
It might have been quite different if someone else had been if Steve Kleene had been the person starting it, or someone else. At this time, a tremendous number of people in the mathematics department are interested in computing, but the people that are most interested are the logicians.
Is that to be expected?
In a way, not by me, but it's true. I have close connections with most of the logicians. That is, we have common interests, and the kinds of things that I do have no relationship with computer science. They simply don't involve that kind of number analysis. The logicians also do work which is of a different type, which involves finite combinatorics, which is what computing does more for you with, and they are very knowledgeable about this and therefore able to quickly learn something, and it's interesting. I think if any mathematician who starts trying to learn something about it gets involved and gets interested.
Did the math department have trouble getting access to the computer? I think
actually they haven't had any access essentially until they don't have normal ways of getting access to the computer. They don't have money that allows them to use the computer. And you have to have money to use it. And so they don't normally have any direct use of it. They have they have small computers in the math department now, but that's only very recently. And so that anyone using the using the computer science department or using computers in any way. Right now, people teaching calculus may be able to arrange for their students to have an hour's work on the computer sometime. But they have to really negotiate with the university for this, and it has to be money coming out of a particular pocket, and it doesn't come naturally. It has to be negotiated for.
So that must be a problem.
Oh, yes, it's a problem. It's a real problem.
It's a source of friction, I imagine.
Right. Well, it's not not a great source of friction. It just means that the mathematics department doesn't use the computers as much as they would if they could, if they didn't have to. If you have to do something, if something is difficult to do, and you have to rearrange it every time you do it, you don't do it most of the time. Only when you're feeling terribly eager do you go out and fight for the money to do it. So very often, when the mathematics department students would profit by access to the computer, and when the mathematicians themselves would profit by access to the computer, they simply don't do it because they know it would take time and energy to get it. They could more easily sit in their office and play with their pencils and paper than they could. It isn't clear which would give them more, and so if they had easy access, they would go try it on the computer first. But since it involves arranging for it ahead of time, they may never do it.
So this
that way.
Must have an effect on
the And this, again, and has an effect on the interest, the knowledge, and the research of the mathematics department. That is, this keeps the mathematics department quite separate from the computer science department, because anyone who was interested in computers probably wouldn't want to deal with it that way. They'd rather be at a place where it was easily accessible.
Has this been made it troublesome to recruit people? Of course,
no.
You haven't been able
not
to
that,
recruit
not that we've, not that we've ever noticed. Oh. Let's put it that way.
I wonder if the Army Math Research Center, they must have that.
They have access. They have money to do this, and so the people that are there, and actually that's been the reason that it hasn't, I'm sure that there hasn't been more of a crisis of doing something to change the situation. The people that are at the Math Research Center have access and have money set aside for access, and they do this easily, and therefore they anyone who's interested in numerical analysis probably has part-time something from the Math Research Center, so that it makes people who have interests in this direction go to the Math Research Center, or you know, it changes the difference in where you are too. But there's very little contact at the present time. Actually, only in 2 years ago, we lost two of our very well-known logicians, John Barwise and Ken Cunin. One went to Stanford, one went to the University of Texas. And while at the University of Texas, Cunin became very involved in computer science because it was very available there, and he could play with the computer from the mathematics department.
Yeah.
And he got to doing things with people in computer science. At Stanford, Barwise also became more interested in computing than he had been, and when they wanted to come back to the University of Wisconsin, they asked to come back half and half, half in computer science and half in mathematics. And that isn't entirely, I think they wanted their home to be mathematics, but to be on loan to the computer science department. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, something like that has been arranged.
Oh, they are coming back.
Yeah. They are back.
Oh.
They are both partly on leave and partly working in the computer science department, both of them. So we now have two more people that are crossing those lines. Seymour Parter is a man who's basically a computer scientist who is in the mathematics department, and we do so that we've had that contact for years. But that's the only, well, I guess Ed Moore also is a part of each, but they are the only people that had crossed these lines, and their primary interest had been computer science.
And did
while
the did the computer science department, they accepted these people?
Yes. They were enthusiastic to have them. They would very much like to have, they were very, the logicians are interested in proof theory and abstract sorts of things in computer science, and we have almost no one in the University of Wisconsin doing that kind of thing in computer science. We can't hire good young people who are interested in proof theory, because we don't have any old people who are interested in proof theory. That is, they want someone to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer science department is having trouble recruiting because they don't have the more abstract type people in the computer science department. And they are eager to have this contact, and they have money to hire people.
They do, even now.
Even now, while we don't. Well, they have an expanding department.
Yes.
And it's reasonable that they should hire people. But they would like to hire some people that they can't hire without having more pure mathematical contact.
Now, Mervyn Muller seems to have had a role in all of this. Did you know him?
No.
You don't? Well,
I really don't.
Because one, I read the statement that he set computing back at the University of Wisconsin very seriously.
Yeah.
And
I don't know anything about this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is all Preston Hammer then, isn't it?
Strange.
You don't know when he left? Was it that he was given a better offer? Do you know anything about that?
I think he was given an attractive offer. I think he was aware that the mathematics department was not enthusiastic over some of his mathematical ideas, and that he took it for very much the same reasons that people of 45 take offers when they get them. He was
feeling
something new.
Alive.
This is he's still alive. There was something interesting to do. Mm-hmm. He would go do something. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he was feeling kicked out by the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that. I just don't know for sure. But I think he took it in a fairly straightforward kind of way.
From what you say, it wouldn't be wise to embark upon an interview with him when he comes in April.
Why not?
It might be a rather long and perhaps.
Might be more interesting than average.
Well,
I'll tell him when he if he comes and I see him, I'll tell him I have a friend who might be interested in meeting him.
That letter alone is, in a way, conveys the man, I imagine, as well.
Don't say anything. Right.
Well, we were also going to talk about Steve Kleene.
That's what happened.
And said, is he always this unforthcoming, or whatever the word was I used, and you called me up the next morning.
Yeah.
Tell me some more, which is I was very glad you did.
Yeah. I would be glad to answer any questions you had there.
Well, let's see. Well, it's the MRC and the beginnings of that.
The MRC was an idea, or perhaps I'm not sure who suggested it. Perhaps the Army suggested it, and perhaps we bid for it. But at any rate, one of the people that was interested in this from the beginning was Steve Kleene,
mm-hmm.
And Rudolf Langer was certainly the person who was most involved,
mm-hmm.
and was the head of it. But Steve thought it was good for the mathematics department to have an extra group coming that was interested in applied mathematics, a group that was being paid for by somebody else. He encouraged, I'm sure, the beginning of the Math Research Center, and at one time when it was in need of a director for a year or two, he was director.
Mm-hmm.
He has never been really very closely involved, except that he's been advisory, I think, over a long period of years,
mm-hmm.
and he certainly was the person most responsible for Rosser's coming.
Yes,
between Langer, mm-hmm. and Rosser. That was the period when he briefly was the man that was in charge, and he chose a friend of his who does exactly the same kind of mathematics, Rosser, who had been doing some work for the military in Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lab there that Rosser had been involved in, and had been involved in the kind of things connected with computers and the kinds of things connected with applied mathematics of various kinds that Steve had been involved,
mm-hmm.
in. So, much more so, actually. Steve had been very peripheral to this. He had some knowledge, but not any real personal involvement. So, he was responsible for Rosser's coming. He was the mathematics department in 1970, in the late 60s and early 70s, when the Vietnam War was a tremendous issue, became positively embarrassed by the existence of the Math Research Center,
yes,
because of its connection with the Army. They were not interested in promoting things military. They were not very enthusiastic over it being blamed on them, in some sense. That is, that they were in bad repute with the rest of the campus,
yes,
because they had a something connected with the Army, connected with them. And they would like to have been very separate from it. There were people in the mathematics department at all times, however, that were involved in some way with the Math Research Center. And perhaps Steve Kleene was one of those who was always in some minor way involved with it. At any rate, he never rejected it. He never was violently against it. And there were, I think, 90% of the math department really felt that the Math Research Center...
The Math Research Center was being put down more than was reasonable.
They were not involved in the kind of terrible military activity which they were being accused of by the more radical elements on campus. The mathematics department knew the people who were doing mathematics there. They knew the kinds of mathematics that they were doing. They were well aware of exactly what was being done there, and that it wasn't anything very terrible. The only thing that was terrible about it, so far as they were concerned, was that it was being paid for by the Army. And the fact that it was being paid for by the Army meant that the Army got more money, got more overhead. They didn't like that fact, but they never really felt that it was a terrible place in the way that many groups on campus viewed it. If you don't know what's going on there, you may think that they're doing terrible things. If you do know what's going on, why, then you are less concerned. There were some votes taken, perhaps, I don't remember exactly what, which in some ways said we disapprove of the existence of this organization, but they probably weren't 90% votes. They were probably 60% votes.
Well, it was 23-4 or something
okay.
like that. So clearly, not everybody voted.
Okay, and not everybody was there voting.
Yes, right.
They may have chosen not to vote,
mm-hmm.
Partly because they didn't want to be put in the position of voting for or against.
Mm-hmm.
Those who felt very strongly against came and voted, and those who felt a little wishy-washy just avoided the issue.
Do you
in some sense.
Whether you
I don't.
There?
I don't remember whether I was there or not. But I guess I felt a little wishy-washy. I don't know whether I might have gone and voted or not. But I was drawn a little bit in two ways. At that time, there was also controversy between the faculty and the students.
Yes.
The students were very militant, understandably. And the faculty was not so militant, there was real pressure between the two because
about,
of this.
You talking about all the students or the graduate students?
I was talking about the graduate students in mathematics primarily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was also true of the students in general, but actually not so much.
Well,
the mathematics graduate students were more militant than average,
yes,
I think
that's true.
They still are.
Yeah,
they were among the leaders of the militant groups,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted support from the faculty who weren't quite willing to go as far as the students would have liked for them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some confrontation between there was some bad feeling between the two groups. They never ceased to talk. They never ceased to have a lot of intimate contact, actually. But at the same time, there was a definite barrier for the first time. They had been very close before, and actually they have gotten very close again. But at the same time, at that time, the faculty disapproved in general of the teaching assistants going on strike.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now this was, after all, fairly mild in comparison with some of the things that were going on, but they really felt like, well, maybe they shouldn't go on strike. I think later, actually, they were more supportive of this, and that the math department came around to the idea that the Teaching Assistants Association was a good thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Long after the rest of the department had the rest of the university had rejected the Teaching Assistants Association, the math department really began to feel like it was fairly a good thing because it forced small classes, which the university was not able to support unless they were forced, or was not willing to support unless they were forced, and really it's very helpful in mathematics to have small classes. And the math department would prefer to have small classes. It would make for a much better university with small classes, and they viewed then the Teaching Assistants Association as something that was on their side, trying to help them get small classes. This was the main thing, in a way, that the Teaching Assistants Association ever achieved.
You're the first person that's ever said that. Many people have realized that the TAA, the teaching assistants needed some sort of organization, but nobody's ever said that the department's benefited.
The department definitely has benefited from that. There was some controversy early on over whether the idea, I think most of the mathematicians in the math department, that is the faculty, would not like to have a union for the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
That is, there are some members of the faculty in the mathematics department who belong to the United Faculty and other union types, they've been very tolerant of their fellow members who had that feeling, but most of them did not want a union for the faculty, really. I think the majority, maybe 80%, maybe less than that, maybe 60%. Would have preferred not to have a union for the faculty, but the teaching assistants had the right to have a union, I think they really felt rather strongly, and that the math department might even profit by it. It was also something that was evident to them.
Mm-hmm. From that period, the names like Langer and Rosser and Seymour Parter come to me through rather an aura of disapproval, I wonder what kind of people they were.
I think were much too rigid for the times. That is, they were unwilling to bend much.
Do you think of the? Oh, all right. I do because of that, but I just wonder, as individuals, what were they like?
They were very, very different kinds of people. Seymour Parter is a man who talks a great deal, very interested in applied mathematics, was very opposed to the protests of the students, not because he was interested. None of these people, I'm not sure about how Rosser felt about the war in Vietnam, that is, or about U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rosser's was much more involved with the military, actually. That is, that he was more interested in the United States maintaining military superiority than in lots of other things. That is, he is the only one of the group who had any interest in this direction, I think. That is, that he's the only one that thought in those terms at all. At the same time, Kleene thought he was, I'm sure that actually that fact about Rosser was something that made Kleene think he might be very good at it. good at handling this job with the military group, and that at the time that he brought him, he didn't think about it as being a terribly bad thing to have the military. You're not too far from World War II, you know.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Where everyone was working to promote the military.
Mm. Well, it was before the war, I believe.
Right.
AMRC
started
before the
Vietnam
War.
Yeah. And so the fact that it turned into a bad thing, Pliny was very opposed to the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't make him think that Rosser was a bad man.
Yeah.
And he brought him in before it became an issue.
And what about Langer?
Langer was an old school mathematician who his field was differential equations. He ran the math research center like a military establishment almost. That is, I mean, it was kept locked up. You
I've
had
heard
to go.
That. Yes, the
this kind of
did,
right. Mm. There were various things like this that were very strange about it. On the other hand, I didn't know Langer very well. He sort of vanished before I became. I just never got to know him very well. He was separated. Yeah.
Picks him out as one of the outstanding mathematicians.
He was a very capable mathematician. And the fact that he started this mathematics research center gave it prestige in the mathematical community.
Yeah.
And has kept it very strong, perhaps, in differential equations. That's still its strong area.
Hmm.
You might not think that that would be the area where it would be extremely strong, but it is.
Equations is a term I know about.
Yeah, right.
And
Parter is the only one of this group that's still very much a part of the mathematics department. He is a much younger man. He's 52 or 3, something like this, now. And he was very much, I guess he was just a little more politically right, but at the same time, that's not true. He just was very much opposed to the way in which the students were protesting the Vietnam War. The people who were chairman of departments at the time of the protests on campus took a great deal of flack.
Yes.
And every one of them became much more rigid was than their nature because they were put in the position of being the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it made them all much more conservative, shall we say, than their natures would have made them.
I can certainly think of some examples.
Yeah, right. It certainly happened in the mathematics department, and I think it happened even more to Seymour Parter in the computer science department. He was chairman of the computer science department at that time.
I see.
And as someone who had people working for the Mathematics Research Center and people who... he was really singled out as being a terrible man.
Yeah.
And I don't think he saw himself that way, and he came back very angry, so that this made it a hard place for him to be in.
Hmm.
But I think he is a softer man in general than the other
man
is. Right. He came to Madison as a very young man. A very idealistic man who had grown up on a farm in Maine, who spent a year on this farm all by himself, a whole winter as a 16-year-old without water anything around. He was a very private, a very quiet reserved, strange personality type man. And he had met and married the daughter of the president of Bowdoin College, where he had gone to school, a very eccentric, tall woman. She developed cancer, she had a retarded child, she became more and more strange, and she died 10 years ago, but it was a long process. She had cancer for 20 years. And so they had twin sons and another son and a daughter who was severely retarded. And they lived in Shorewood, and they were here from the mid-1930s until now. Mm-hmm. Kleene came on a salary of $2,000 or $1,000, and then got told when he arrived that it would be 25% less, a voluntary kind of thing. Yeah. A story he's very fond of telling. When he came back from World War II, there was no housing, and they lived in, they had lived at university houses before, and they lived in out in Baraboo, and came in on the bus, and he was very much involved in the building of university houses, and the building of his house in Shorewood was something that he was very attached to. And he felt very responsible for the University of Wisconsin, felt very much like a father of the University of Wisconsin. He views it in a very personal way. That is, it's to some extent his baby.
Yeah.
He really sees it that way. He was in charge of the building of Van Vleck.
Yes.
And oh my, he took lots of personal care with this and was tremendously involved in every aspect of the building much more so than would be normal for someone who was just on the building committee. Yeah. I mean, he really, it was his building. Mm-hmm. And he was very careful about what kinds of bathrooms there were. He was very careful about what kinds of coffee cups there were. He was very excited over involving his old friends in making the lounge on the ninth floor nice. He got Ingram and Van Vleck involved in this. He was very careful to see that there were blackboards, not slate blackboards, not paper blackboards, slate! Well, it was a time when all kinds of fancy stuff was being used for blackboards, and they often, mathematicians use a blackboard all the time.
Yes.
And they hate these synthetic things because they don't write so well. And he saw to it that Van Vleck had slate blackboards, which are very expensive.
Yes,
sure. And there are even slate blackboards in the offices. I mean, all over Van Vleck there are good slate blackboards. I mean, other things might have been cut, but he fought to the bitter end to see that there were slate blackboards all over the building. Was very careful that the offices should be of a size that one person would fit in them reasonably well, but you couldn't possibly put two people in. Mathematicians need a private office.
Yeah.
And he fought for various kind of things like this, which he considered very important for mathematicians as opposed to other people. And he spent a great deal of time and energy on that project.
Yeah.
He has been very fatherly towards other aspects of the University of Wisconsin, like the Computer Science Department and MRC, and just the L&S College in general.
Mm-hmm.
He feels very much like one of those who can do something good or bad for it, and is very determined that the good thing shall be done. He has a very New England sense of right and wrong and what should be correct, and he always does what he thinks is correct. It's part of his character to do that. He had served, I think, twice as chairman of the math department. Was it just once?
Yes, there was a there one year period, and then a two-year
period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much his idea that there should be, that the chairman of the department should be not just average run-of-the-mill professors, but the very top research people should serve as chairman of the department, mm-hmm. and that they should serve, but only very briefly, because it takes too much from your research to do it. But the idea that you have a chairman for 1 year or 2 years is, I think, a cleany idea.
So he
And he's very influential in the way the thing developed.
He must have been very vocal. And
oh, yeah.
I think of him as being rather remote.
The things that he wanted, he really, he had relatively few of them, but he did not get involved in a lot of controversy. He simply just divorced himself from it.
Mm-hmm.
But when he chose, the things he chose to get involved in, he was very much very vocal when it was when he felt it was important to be vocal.
Well, how did the department take to all to this sort of thing?
They, like naughty children. they, in general, don't like to be told what to do. They appreciated very much his construction of the building, and they were aware that Cleany wanted good things for them. I think they were very aware of that, and that they. He was very much opposed to anyone ever bringing a coffee cup into the lounge. You should drink your coffee in the kitchen. You shouldn't drop coffee on the rug or spill coffee on the tables. And instantly, that was disobeyed by everybody. And he was just, it was Cleany's idea that you shouldn't have to get on the elevator unless you had a key, that students didn't need to ride the elevator. Only people who needed to go from the very basement to the very top needed to ride the elevator. And that was immediately disobeyed. And there are other things like this. When his ideas were not to everyone's pleasure, people just did something else.
How did you take that about the lounge? Do you
He took it badly, but eventually gave in. That is, he had very strong opinions about how things should be used, and he. But he recognized when he was overrun. I mean, when he would, when he couldn't. I think he had a modest sense. He would fight for what he thought was right longer than was reasonable. On the other hand, he did have some judgment of when he had lost a battle and ceased to fight. He was always viewed by the mathematics department as too rigid and too ungood with people. They didn't let this deter their view of him as a superb mathematician or as a person who basically wanted good things for the university. That is, they saw him this way. And
did it express itself as fear or dislike having him around? Anything?
No, nothing. So they were never afraid of him. I think, in general, the mathematics department knew that they were just seen as a bit quirky.
Hmm.
Without being
Cleany, who's going to make us do something?
I don't think they felt threatened by him.
No, but I mean, I mean, when he came in and you
they
all had your coffee cups on the table,
I think people were perfectly willing to argue with him on this subject and not be put down by him.
Yeah.
That is, he never achieved a position of sufficient power to control people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I wonder why not.
Well, lots of people having different ideas. You
maybe too many.
Too many.
Too many people.
Yeah, right.
Because I think some
if it were
chairman,
the chairman in the math department is a servant and not a power.
Mm.
Never has the chairman had any power whatsoever. The chairman of the mathematics department is the servant of the mathematics department who goes and visits the dean and negotiates what the math department wants, not what the chairman wants. The chairman has no more power than any, than the smallest person in the department. He actually, by what he brings up at what meetings, he probably does have a little power, but it isn't really felt in the math department that he has any power, and if anybody wants to have a meeting, they can have a meeting. And he doesn't get to vote, and he doesn't get to... So his power is very limited, and everything is decided more or less by the entire group, including, well, salaries are decided by a committee of the full professors, not by the chairman. Things are not, the chairman has almost no power at all, no power over who shall be. He certainly has no power over bringing in people.
I see, yeah.
He certainly has no power over, that's decided by the entire department. He has no power over salaries. He has no power over how the courses are run. Really, he's a person who works for the department. It's a service position.
Do you remember the there was an issue where, I think it was Langer wanted a particular person and Cleaney wanted Box, I think?
Maybe.
Sort of the statistics
department.
I just, this would have been Langer as, I suppose, the MRC.
Langer was chairman of the department for a long time.
That's what he was.
And actually, I think Cleaney was one of the people who was responsible for saying it's not good to have a man be chairman of the math department for a long period of time.
Oh.
For instance, Langer has been chairman too long. So that Cleaney had his differences with Langer.
Yeah, I know.
Over what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I think he admired Langer and Langer admired him. That is, they both had certain admiration for each other as mathematicians and as people who wanted something for the university. They were both powerful men. That is, they were people who had and wanted power.
Were you surprised that he was made dean?
Not especially. He was very close friend of Young,
yes,
and had been for many, many years, and I think Young viewed him as someone he could completely trust, always do more or less what Young thought was correct.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether Young thought he could persuade Steve Cleaney what was correct or not.
So
but they had very similar ideas, yeah. I think, about what was good for the university, so that I think it was a natural choice of dean from Young's standpoint.
Mm-hmm. But
it took pressure off of Young to have Steve Cleaney siting there between the rest of the world.
Well, you felt that he damaged the department, and you did use decisions.
I don't know that he really damaged the department in serious ways. He was very rigid with the mathematics department, and, which he was with every department in the university. I think, to some extent, the setup of the university is that the LNS dean stands there saying no to everything you want. He has enormous power, and anything that you want to do, you have to go through him to do. And so it was a time when the university was cutting back.
Yes.
Therefore, to have a man who was completely rigid and who was unswayable was very important to the university, maybe. If you're cutting back, you've got to have someone who will say no.
What do you say no to?
Well, he said no to many things that previous deans would have said yes to, and he said no to the mathematics department with exactly the same frequency and firmness that he said no to the history department.
You know, and this gave him power over the math department that he
would not have had otherwise, right.
Do you think he disapproved, for instance, of these two administrators whom he got rid of, I guess, when he was on the faculty of the math department?
He probably would have disapproved. He would have voted against keeping them if he had been there. He might not have, depending, but he probably would have. His view of the mathematics department is that it should consist exclusively of first-class research people, which is not a bad view, actually. But from time to time, the math department wanted other things, and he just wasn't willing to go along with it. It's true that he had control in a way that he wouldn't have had control if he had been just a voting member of the department, or if he had been chairman when he didn't even have a vote. But I don't think he used this power differently for the mathematics department than he did for other departments.
No, I don't think so. I think the
mathematics department viewed him as fair, even though much more not always wanting what they wanted. Mm.
It sounds unrealistic to me to want first-class researchers in a department that has so much of the courses of which are with freshmen who are nothing to do with mathematical research and do have to be handled.
Yeah. It's true, and it's frequently happens at the math department decides they will deal with that problem too. On the other hand, what makes Harvard different from Michigan State is that Harvard's faculty consists almost exclusively of first-class research men, while Michigan State deals more with the students that they have before them. And it was Kleene's notion that we should be more like Harvard.
Yeah.